Ed, welcome to the Bitcoin Infinity Show. Nice to have you here.
It is an absolute pleasure to be with you.
Fantastic. We haven't seen each other in real life since a New Year's Eve's party, a bit longer than a year ago, I guess. And before that, we met in Amsterdam over a couple of beers at one of the BTC Media conferences over there, I believe.
Bitcoin Amsterdam. I'm walking back to the hotel and somebody introduces you to me and I'm like, you want to grab a beer? I was like, sure. And then I'm like, who are you? And it was embarrassingly, I'd never heard of you.
No, but if I remember correctly, you used to live in Amsterdam, right?
Well, I used to live in Amsterdam, but that was during the Bitcoin 23 conference. And so you and I sat down and I just got to get to know you over many, many beers. Mike Germano joined us for a while. But proved to be increasingly embarrassing the more we talked, how much I didn't know who were.
No.
But it's amazing, isn't it? As long as we've been in Bitcoin and it's like every now and then someone that just was on our periphery comes into it and you're like, where have you been?
It's amazing how big this space is and how multifaceted it is, because I stumble upon people I've never heard of that has been here since forever. Once in a while too, and some people keep a low profile and some people are just in a completely different like subset of interests within the Bitcoin space, which is ironically enough sort of why I wanted you to have you on the show and talk about this Bitcoin strategic reserve companies, which is something I very seldomly talk about, funnily enough. I just haven't like had a proper pod about that subject. And I know
we'll try to touch it here because I'm incredibly intimidated being on your podcast, because when I listen to your podcast, I always feel like I'm going to one day come on this thing and just get wrecked by you. But if you're gentle with me, I'll try to give you how I see it. You know, you also mentioned that we had met at Saylor's 100K party. And last week I was in Vegas at the Strategy World Bitcoin for Corporations conference and ran into an ex-employee, an ex-colleague there. And
yeah, this is a preamble. You used to work for Strategy.
Yeah, I used to work there, right.
Anymore.
I started in December of 24. And it was funny because when I started, the price was like 90 something. And these employees were asking me, when do you think we're going to, you know, break 100? And I said, well, I don't think it'll be until, you know, mid 25, just because I felt like that's where the cycles were going, whatever. And sure enough, it was like 2 days later that it broke 100K. And they're all like, so you don't know. And I'm like, no, I don't know. But then the next day it dropped below 100 and came back above 100. And then now look where we are. The other interesting thing about that is that when we had the 100K party in Miami, I got two separate messages. I got one from a guy in Europe who goes, what is this 100K party? And said, well, it's Bitcoin crossed 100,000. He's like, 100,000 what? I'm like, well, dollars. And he's like, oh yeah, because he only thinks in euros, right? And and so he wasn't even watching the price in dollars. And so he didn't understand that it had broken $100,000. Okay, myopic, whatever. And then another guy in Argentina who wrote me, he said, yeah, we're about to break 100 million pesos, right?
Yeah,
but it really opened my eyes to like, hey, Bitcoin is not just something denominated in dollars, right? It is denominated in your local currency that you have to use to spend, to eat, to pay rent, whatever. And so for us to keep celebrating this 100K number, okay, X percent of the Bitcoin market is in dollars. We should appreciate that. But there are other people around the world that say, it doesn't really matter to me, that 100K number.
No, and I remember there's a bit more like history to this. I remember the first time at Saylor's house was a couple of years before that. I believe in 22, could be mistaken, but and that was Bitcoin was at 40K, and I was there with Daniel Prince, who has a podcast too, and we had started this whole meme about the 100K party, and tagged Saylor in, hey, Saylor, when are you going to throw this 100K party? And there we found ourselves there at 42K or something, just giggling, like, look at this, we're on the yacht and we're not even close to 100K. And then there was the actual 100K party last year then, so that was hilarious. Or well, can you say last year or the year before? Well, it was both because it was New Year's Eve. Yeah, it's a bit more than a year ago. Anyway, a very fun event. I was sort of stunned by how many shitcoiners there were at the event. I would have expected more Bitcoin only focus, but I think that was partly due to them giving away some of the guest list planning thing to BTC Media and Bailey and the bunch, like handpicking is not maybe the handpicking I would have done getting crypto people there. But
yeah, I don't remember that wasn't something that I really noticed there being a lot of shitcoin people there. It was his party, right? It was Michael's party.
Yeah.
It wasn't like a officially sanctioned strategy party or anything. So he had invited a lot of his friends from the Miami area. So that might have been why there were people that are on the periphery of Bitcoin or shitcoiners or whatever you want to call them.
Yeah, right? And I think also friends of Michael's friends, because I think he's sort of friends of friends. So it's not like I'm fishing for a guilt by association thing here. It's just but it was an interesting event, to say the least. It's like for me, it's not an everyday thing to go to a billionaire's party like that.
Yeah,
usually doesn't happen.
This is a good question, right? Because when I arrived at Strategy, I had a little bit of panic. I was like, oh my God, I'm a fraud. What am I doing here? I'm going to be the director of Bitcoin advocacy at Strategy, the biggest, Bitcoin company in the world. And it's widely known that, there's not a ton of hardcore Bitcoiners at the company, right? The company in general is all well-educated on Bitcoin. They understand Bitcoin. But if you said, how many Bitcoiners are there at Strategy? It's in the low double digits. And so it really made me start to ask the question, like, what is a Bitcoiner? Who is a Bitcoiner? How do you qualify? How do you get your card, right? Where do you get your degree in it? And, I would go to East Denver or to these other events because I wanted to see what they were doing. And then I'd go up to Bitcoiners. I go, you see what they're doing over there on Solana? Can you do that on Bitcoin? They're like, no. I'm like, well, then shut up and go build it on Bitcoin. Right. But to ostracize them and to say you're a shitcoiner because there's some centralized control over your token, I don't know. I struggle with that. It's that idea of, the Bitcoin maxi and the toxic Bitcoin maxi versus people who are looking for some other goal. I'd love to hear your thoughts.
I know this is going to be a juicy conversation then, because I'm on the opposite side of that spectrum. Because the way I see it, Bitcoin is money, and anything other than a monetary use case is an abuse case. And it nibbles away at Bitcoin's functionality as money. And I think it's crucial that we keep it that way and keep it pure and keep it simple, stupid, like, and do not make it into Solana or ETH 2.0 or whatever, because we've seen what happens when you try to use this technology to build anything else. It just goes to shit and everyone gets rugged and there's just pyramids on top of pyramids and it all goes to shit. And that's why I've been very skeptic about the strategic reserve companies also, because I think back to Daniel Prince, he has a great saying, fiat around and find out. And I think that's what's happening with these things now. Like a lot of these companies, like I have nothing against a company holding Bitcoin. I have a hard time though understanding exactly what that means, because to me, not your keys, not your coins is just as true now as it was back in 2016. Like it doesn't matter who you are or where you are in life. If you're holding your Bitcoin with a custodian, that to me is paper Bitcoin and not actual Bitcoin. So you still have this counterparty risk and you're not really taking the leap of reason into the full potential of this world. You're still living with a fiat mindset. You're still denominating in fiat. You still acquire the Bitcoin in order to get more fiat or to make more fiat for your investors or whatever. And to me, that is not the revolution I signed up for. I signed up for
me neither.
Killing the dollar.
Don't get me wrong. Me neither. I approach it from you know, what kind of Bitcoiner am I? Where do I fit into this? You know, this term Suitcoiner came up along the way, and Pledditor takes credit, and Jack Mallers takes credit. And then I leaned into it with PodConf and said, yeah, I'm a Suitcoiner. And then they said, oh, Suitcoiners are people on Wall Street who are using Bitcoin for their own means. And I got really offended by that. And I said, no, a Suitcoiner is a Bitcoiner that wears a suit. And it's all definitions again, right? But I think what you're asking is like, are Bitcoin treasury companies just financial engineering? Is this just rebuilding the fiat system on top of Bitcoin? Is that kind of your doubt?
But before we go into that, I'd like to say that I did understand more about specifically strategy or MicroStrategy. Let's just call them MicroStrategy for sake of ease here, but the strategy of strategy in Lugano this summer, because Preston Pysh was there and he had a long lecture, even two lectures, I think, about the subject of how Saylor's portfolio of products built upon Bitcoin work. And what I got away from that is it's like he's sort of building a, you imagine this dam or this pool of boomer money that is inaccessible, it cannot flow over to Bitcoin because they don't understand how to do that. So instead of doing that, he's like making that pond, there's a waterfall at the edge of it. And instead of trying to direct the waterfall into Bitcoin, he's sort of building a power generator next to the waterfall. And that are all the MicroStrategy products that can make, like, it's a bit of a bad analogy. I can't repeat his analogy because I don't remember it that well. But he's sort of building a way for Bitcoin to slurp up all the money that is in the boomer money pool. That otherwise wouldn't have been accessible to Bitcoin. So in that sense, his more fiat monetary power, if you will, is being funneled into the Bitcoin space. And yeah. I guess that's a good thing. But it's all, to me, there are very many like third parties involved, and very much it's hinged on the good intentions of very many people, not only Strategy, but Michael himself, and of course, Coinbase, and whoever's the CEO of Coinbase at the time, and also the guy who actually owns the private keys. And I think this is the most interesting aspect of it. I guess there's some multisig or something and multiple jurisdictions, and they're, you know, obligated to do this and that. But to me, if you have the private key, if you have access to it, you control the Bitcoin, meaning that you could just F off whenever you want and buy an island somewhere and just disappear from the face of the earth, and poof, all that money is gone. Like, and to me, that's the beauty of Bitcoin. Like, I'm here for, you know, the final scene of Fight Club, where all the credit card companies' skyscrapers keep falling, and I've just shot myself through the head and taken, like, that's what I'm looking forward to. Like, and I don't think I share that opinion with the Suitcoiners. So yeah. What do you say to that?
Well, you know, you on a podcast you did just a few weeks ago, you mentioned an analogy to Minecraft, which has just stuck in my head and been beautiful. It, you know, Minecraft has rules, it has a kind of objectives, but maybe you're just there to build, right? And to make something beautiful, right? There is no way to win. And that's really stuck with me lately, because, you know, when I built my first computer in 1986, to date myself there, but I had to get a motherboard, and then I had to get a jumper cable, and I had to get a floppy drive, and then you'd get a new floppy drive, or you'd get a new whatever, and you'd put it together. And then, who was it? It was like Zenith and IBM and Acer. They said, we're going to do a vanilla box that you can't open, right? And I said, nobody's ever going to buy that. Who's going to want a vanilla box that you can't open? Well, guess who won, right? And that's the whole story of early adoption. All they really wanted was a spreadsheet and a word processor and solitaire. I've been quoted on this, and because I wrote about it, was that I thought orange pilling was over. I think that you know, the early adoption phase is done. We're crossing the chasm, or we've crossed the chasm, and now we're looking at the early majority. Now, the question is, how do you keep the early majority honest? right? How do you keep the early majority focused on the original intentions and goals of the innovators and the early adopters? This all goes back to Geoffrey Moore's book. And you look at the case of like VHS Betamax. Betamax is a superior technology. It's the direction we should have gone with videotapes, but Sony kept it under their patent control. And the porn industry saw VHS as cheap, and we all ended up with VHS tapes. And it's like, okay, so that's how it can go off the rails, right? That you don't get the purest form of the technology. So Bitcoin is unique in that aspect, and that, you know, we've got this army of cyber hornets that are trying to keep everybody honest and saying, you know, that wasn't the original intention. So treasury companies, like you said, they're not replacing self-custody. They're onboarding institutions that can't self-custody directly, right? These institutions are saying, we're under rules and regulations that say we can only invest in certain things. And then Saylor sits there and says, yeah, and you got a lot of money. How can I create a bridge? How can I create a capital formation vehicle, a public market infrastructure? How can I create something that allows you to come into the world of Bitcoin under the current rules and regulations with the eventual goal that, yes, everyone will self-custody, every company will self-custody. But if we just wait for all the rules and regulations to change, then it's just going to take forever. So I think this has really been a question of how far do we want to bend the knee to allow others in without sacrificing our principles?
Yeah, that's exactly it. I mean, but if you look at email, for instance, almost no one runs their own email server at home. Like everyone uses a centralized service, and it's super convenient and it works for the most part, but our emails are getting read by AI bots that look for certain words so that certain institutions can come and do things to us if we say the wrong things to the wrong people. It's not private. It's not sovereign. It's a service, and we pay for services. Like, same thing, is very kin, to me, is very akin to the whole MP3 revolution when that happened and all the record companies were had their panties in an uproar and were all screaming at one another and, you know, the drummer from Metallica suing Napster and all of that era, like a wonderful era of the internet. And the CEO of Napster came to this MTV Music Award with a Metallica t-shirt, and the host of the show said, "Oh, nice t-shirt." And he replies, "Oh, it's not mine. I borrowed it from a friend." And it's just so beautiful, you know, a middle finger to everything old. And the internet sort of pointed out that information wants to be free. It yearns to be free. Copyright laws and patent laws are products of the anomaly in human history, which is the 20th century, the century where you could make money off of mass producing information. And you couldn't do that before the 20th century because the technology wasn't there. And I don't think you can do that after the 20th century because information is practically free now. And of course, instead you get cataloging services like Spotify and whatever other music apps there are out there. And I think with Bitcoin, it's a very similar thing. It's just that money touches absolutely everything. And these are the most powerful institutions in the world, and they are going to have to change. So like trying to build these fiat financial products on top of it, it's sort of like the square peg in the round hole, if you know what I mean. Like it's trying to, what's the equivalent in the... Well, it's at best, it's building Netflix and HBO when the Pirate Bay already exists, if you know what I mean. The real freedom is there for those brave enough to take it. And I guess I somewhat understand onboarding normies will require this funneling. What I'm afraid of is that everything gets, if you look at like the streaming services, for instance, sorry for ranting for long here, Ed, but no, like, no. Like I'd like to make the case. So if you look at Netflix and HBO and Paramount Plus and Disney Plus and whatever the streaming services are called, right? It's the illusion of a free market because they're not really competing with one another because they all have different products. So it's not like you're comparing the subscription of one to the other because you're they're competing for the same movie, they all have rights to different movies, because rights is this thing that we invented in the 20th century that we have something called copyright now, and it's to protect, and then it's been abused ever since, really. So you're creating the illusion of a free market and not really a free market. And I'm afraid that something similar could happen in the Bitcoin space. So you get all these companies that have Bitcoin on the balance sheet. I have nothing against that, by the way. It's just that if that is what triggers the valuation of the stock and stuff, and they don't have a sustainable business underneath, then what's the point? They're just doing this for show, and I know for a fact that some of these companies are only doing this to ride the wave and the hype of this cycle's shitcoins, which is the Bitcoin Strategic Reserve Company. What I would have wished is that more companies dared to just step outside the system completely and realize that to be a company in 2026, you don't even need the legal structure at all. It could just be a signal group with a bunch of Bitcoiners together sharing the loot of whatever they're selling for Bitcoins without anyone being able to interfere with it. And that's sort of more like the direction I think would be preferable. And I see Bailey and his ilk and the similar people pushing for all these other narratives, and they want to get into NASDAQ, and they want to do this and that, and they want to be on the Chicago whatever exchange and stuff. And I'm like, it just makes me yawn, because it to me it sounds like, oh, we're all Gordon Gekko again here, and we're playing the same fucking games that we did back in the fiat days, and it's not the revolution I signed up for.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's why Bitcoin needs you. Bitcoin needs me. Bitcoin needs these early adopters. I hate the phrase OG because I don't even know what that means. I mean, I bought my first Bitcoin in 2011, sold it in 12, then got back in 13 and screwed it up in 15. And I don't even know what class I am, right? I tell people I'm the class of 2039 because that's when I'll finally figure it out, right? It's like, so, you know, part of what I bought into in 2016 when I did a code review with someone. I paid a guy half a Bitcoin to do a code review with me. It took about 3 hours. And I had done enough coding that we were able to go through it block by block. And I said, holy crap, this is like scripture, right? This is something so pure and so different. Didn't really understand all the sound money part of it yet, but just the code itself and how perfectly it worked was like, that's when I said, I'm all in, and moved my IRA to Bitcoin and sold the house into Bitcoin. And, you know, I've been on a Bitcoin standard ever since. You know, even when my bank account gets below 5,000 and my wife gets the notification and I'm like, ah, shit, there's 25,000. Oh, how much do you need in the bank account to feel like we're okay? You know, it's like, it's all going to stay over here in Bitcoin. Then the treasury companies came along, and for the most part, when Saylor did it, I didn't really pay attention to it. I just kind of thought it was, you know, the Wall Streetization of Bitcoin, and I was doing a lot of other stuff. I was working with Mara on this L2 project, and didn't pay attention to it. And so when they called and said, you know, the job opened up for this Bitcoin advocacy, it was to run their conference, but it was also to, you know, educate the employees. And it really got me asking a lot of questions, you know, who is a Bitcoiner? What is a Bitcoin company? I mean, if I ask you, who's the biggest Bitcoin company in the world, what are you going to say?
Well, that's a very good question. Biggest in terms of what?
Yeah, exactly, right?
Yeah.
Everybody always says Strategy right off the bat. And I said, well, why not Tesla?
Well, yeah, I'd say the more interesting question is what is the most impactful Bitcoin company in the world?
Okay. Yeah, sure. And so, you know, this is really getting into this question of, you know, you mentioned Coinbase earlier. Are they a Bitcoin company? I don't think anybody would try to argue that they're a Bitcoin company, but they're part of the Bitcoin ecosystem. You know, Alex Leishman and what he's doing at River, that's about as pure a Bitcoin play as you can get. He's helping a lot of people, you know, get Bitcoin into their wealth portfolio. But, you know, they're still not self-custodying, but it's pretty close. And even the treasury companies themselves, you know, a few have popped up that said, hey, we're going to self-custody. And then they go talk to their insurance company, and then they come back and they say, okay, we're going to custody with Coinbase and Fidelity and Anchorage, because the insurance company is just not set up for that. You know, you can't explain to an insurance company how you're going to self-custody $100 million in Bitcoin and get insured on that yet. So what do you do? Not do it? No, you got to bridge. You got to keep on doing all these little bridges. Now, are there cases where companies have been overzealous and bridged into areas that they just did not know what they were doing? It's happened way too much. One of my best friends lost tens of millions of dollars at Celsius. And I went to a meetup here in Atlanta, and it was a Celsius meetup, and they were all like, hey, we get interest, you get interest, everybody wins. And I had already felt weird about it.
But Celsius didn't have anything to do with Bitcoin, did it?
Celsius did not have anything to do. It was rehypothecation, right? And we, I'll admit, I didn't know what rehypothecation meant. It sounded sexy, right? It sounded sexy. And it was like, okay, now we know rehypothecation is a dirty word. We knew that, you know, this same guy, he had Bitcoin at 10, and this is back in 2013. He had all of his Bitcoin at 10 different exchanges around the world because he didn't know how to do self-custody. And three of those, Chinese, Korean, whatever, disappeared. So he lost 30% of his Bitcoin, but that was his risk management, you know, was to put it at 10 different exchanges because he had so much of it. You know, it was like he didn't know where, and he couldn't figure out the self-custody thing yet in 2013. And it was like, okay, so we're bridging and bridging and bridging. And where I think people like you and people like me, and we've named 10 other names here, come into play is keeping people honest, right? Is making the noise and saying, you know, are we promoting paper Bitcoin? Does owning MSTR or Treasury, does that weaken the case for self-custody? Or are we kind of recreating the ETF culture? Treasury companies aren't replacing individuals. They're just onboarding the pension funds and the insurance companies and the capital allocators. And they're expanding Bitcoin's monetary network effect. So by expanding Bitcoin's monetary network effect, is that good for Bitcoin? Is that good for you and me? I guess it all comes back to how are you doing it, right? If I need an investor for my company and he says, yeah, here's $10 million. And I say, where'd that $10 million come from? Then he goes, don't worry about it. And then I find out he's part of a cartel. Well, then it's a problem, right? So how much due diligence and who's the holder of the truth in the Bitcoin world?
Yeah, this is why it's so different, because there is no holder of truth. Like, you have to do your own homework, and you have to you verify to the whatever extent you can, and since you're responsible yourself, but that was, to me, that was the beauty of the learning curve that was forced upon me. Like when my Bitcoins weren't worth very much in the beginning, this is way before the boating accident where I lost all of it, of course. And then they grew in value to some where I suddenly realized that, holy shit, I'm totally responsible myself for all of this. And therefore, I need to do my homework here, and I need to figure this thing out. And it sort of forces itself on you, that learning curve. And I found that to be a very beautiful part of the system, because it's sort of rewarded responsible behavior, and it punished F around and find out very hard. And that was one of the more beautiful aspects of it. I mean, when you talk about building bridges, for instance, we have one of the companies that are sponsoring this show, the Bitcoin Advisor. It's Peter Dunworth and his bunch there down in Australia. I think they're doing a fantastic job, and I'm not only saying that because they're paying me, but it's not 100% self-custody. It is a multi-sig between them and a custodian and you. So you're sort of bridging in order for them to like be sneaky and take your Bitcoin. They would have to collude with this third-party custodian. And not even then is it very easy. I think they sort of safeguarded in that so you need so that the person's key overrides somehow, or they have some solutions going on. I'm not well read up on the details, but that in itself, they've never lost a Bitcoin for anyone. And then again, they take a substantial fee for storing people's Bitcoin that way, but they can then you can sleep well at night, I guess, because you know that you have your key somewhere. But if someone steals that key, they're not immediately going to get access to the Bitcoins, because there are other hurdles to get you need to get over as an attacker. So
yeah.
So I think there are
that, In the neighborhood that I live in, a number of the other fathers in the neighborhood have come to me, you know, and just say, hey, how do I do this Bitcoin thing? And I don't try to convince, I don't try to orange pill them. And they don't want to be orange pilled, right? What they want to know is how do they get some exposure to Bitcoin? Okay, great. So I go, you can go to Coinbase. It's like E-Trade. No, I don't want to do that. Okay. You could go to Unchained and you get this multi-sig. Well, one guy actually, he liked that. And so he's at Unchained and he's got a key. His wife has a key and Unchained has a key and he feels secure. And he has to pay a big fee to do that. But he sleeps at night. Quick side story. There was a point at which I had everything on a ledger in the safe. And I'd wake up in the middle of the night and go open the safe. And my wife's like, what are you doing? And I'm like, I got to make sure it's there. You know, I would have these panic attacks at night about opening the safe and the ledger's gone. And anyways, then, you know, I would tell other ones, here's River. It's got this amazing UI, UX, and it's as safe as it can get. Or you can get negative yield with an ETF. Like, what do you mean negative yield? I'm like, well, you're getting Bitcoin yield, but you're also paying them to do it for you. And they're like, I can just call my broker and buy it that way. And they're like, yeah, I'm like, that's good for me. And so yeah. I can't orange pill 10 people. I can't orange pill a million people. And so we can provide these different paths and tell them when something's super risky and dangerous. I got one guy that texts me a different shitcoin every week. He says, what do you think about this one? What do you think about this one? I'm like, there's cryptocurrency, stablecoins. There's a crypto asset, Bitcoin, and all the rest are crypto companies run by people. And anytime you get people involved, shit goes wrong, right? Something goes wrong. And yeah, that's what we're trying to do. I mean, you know, I always hesitate on bringing religion into this, but it's like, is the keepers of the truth the Vatican, and then it branches out to all these little churches all over the place. And, you know, then we've got some flexibility. Let me ask you this. Do you know Pope Leo VIII? Of course you don't. Pope Leo VIII was famous for one thing. He put Galileo in jail. Right?
Oh, yeah, yeah. And yep. Burned Bruno, which is Galileo's helping hand there on a stake, I think.
Galileo was the one who said, I think the sun's at the center of the universe. And and they all said, yeah, you're probably right, but it doesn't matter. Right. And then I'm going to forget his name, but the guy who kind of thought up the theory of germ theory, right? And he went to the doctors and he said, you're killing patients by not washing your hands. I'm like, no, we're not. And then even during the internet boom, the Toys R Us's that had all these stores, they're like, we don't need to sell online. We've got all this real estate. And so the keepers of the truth are the ones that have their incentives misaligned. And that's where I'm really concerned about where the early majority is going, because shortly after the 100K party that we mentioned at Sailor's House, I went to the Crypto Ball in DC, and it was David Sachs' coming out party, and they had Snoop Dogg and a couple other rappers for a almost entirely white audience, which was really strange. But you know, Trump announced his Trump coin and Melania coin while we were at the event, and all the Bitcoiners were standing around going, what the hell just happened? You know, we just got backdoored, you know, by someone who said he's a Bitcoiner, but no, he's just part of the early majority. And so how do you keep people honest? Well, I believe, and I hate using the word believe with Bitcoin, because it's like, oh, you believe in Bitcoin? No, Bitcoin's not something you believe in. Right, it's math and it's code. Right, it's like saying I don't believe in gravity. I don't believe in whatever part of science. It's math. It's code. It's going where it's going. But do you believe that the early adopters, the innovators, the people who, like you, who are keeping the truth of Bitcoin, are going to be able to keep the early majority and the late majority and these people who are institutionalizing Bitcoin honest? And I worry about that every day. That's kind of why Tim and I formed Bitcoin Treasuries Media, because we wanted to be kind of a trusted source. We wanted to be this connection layer between the treasury companies, the service providers, and the investors. Provide information, interviews, events where we get people together and you get to make your own call. You know, have we had people on our podcast, on our events that, you know, might end up pulling the rug out or screwing someone over? Yeah, it's possible, but we're really trying to do our due diligence in sacrificing some sponsorship money and some, you know, influence by keeping everybody honest. And it's a hard thing to do when you're running a media company or event company, because there's temptation every day of someone that says like, hey, look, I got this new thing. And you're like, but that doesn't align with Bitcoin. What are you talking about? And they look at me like, don't you want my money? And I'm like, I do, but I mean,
no, I know I run a very small, but still a media company by myself here with Luke. And also that we especially organizing the conferences, Bitcoin Atlantis, I helped out with that a bit. And then even more so with BTC Hell, the Helsinki conference, and picking sponsors and saying no to people that aren't aligned with your values. It's hard. Of course, there's a temptation there. And that's why I think some of these Bitcoin conferences, they choose to go, la, 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 I'm not listening, and just take the money and run. And my friend Giacomo has a great take that there's a balancing act here, and it's between the far ends of a spectrum from pure cypherpunk ethos and adoption. You have to sort of choose where you stand between those two extremes. Yeah. So if you keep the cypherpunk ethos and like everyone should run their own node, and if anyone says anything else, they can go screw themselves. And total adoption, which is like anything that even mentions Bitcoin is good, and therefore we should cheer for Trump selling Melania coin because it's somewhat adjacent to Bitcoin. Everything is good for Bitcoin, that kind of mentality, right? And yeah. I think there's a balance to be struck between the two if we're ever going to be taken seriously by the seriously big money, and at the same time being taken seriously by the really principled, hardcore Austrian economist, cypherpunk ethos people. Like if you want to be taken serious by serious people, you have to find that balance, and it's tricky to find. And we all have different roles to play in that, I think.
Welcome to Knut's super awesome Bitcoin school. Should you use fiat money? Of course not. It's fake. It's counterfeited by the state, and you should buy Bitcoin instead. How do you buy Bitcoin? Well, you can buy them off a friend, or you can go to an exchange. We recommend you go to bullbitcoin.com and buy them over there. They also got an awesome mobile wallet if you should ever want to use your Bitcoin. So go to bullbitcoin.com and use code INFINITY for a discount. If you don't want to sell your Bitcoin, but you want to keep them for a long time, you should put them in some kind of cold storage. For that, we recommend BitVault. BitVault is a wallet that protects you against physical attacks, and they put your Bitcoin in a multi-sig time lock clever solution. So you should check them out at bitvault.sv and use code INFINITY for a discount. To put your Bitcoin in cold storage, you also need a hardware wallet. We recommend the BitBox. BitBox is a great hardware wallet that has been around since forever. It's super easy to use, but also has advanced features, and it's privacy focused. So go to bitbox.swiss and use code INFINITY for a discount. If you need further advice on how to do any of all of this, you should go to thebitcoinadvisor.com. There are friends from Australia, and they're great. They have a multisig setup, a collaborative multisig, so that you can make sure that your descendants and your heirs inherit your Bitcoin when your time is due. So go to thebitcoinadvisor.com and use code INFINITY for a discount. So to recap, get rid of the fiat, and remember, bullbitcoin.com, bitvault.sv, bitbox.swiss, and thebitcoinadvisor.com. Use code INFINITY everywhere. And don't forget to brush your teeth. Over and out.
The best way to look at treasury companies, Knut, is they're not the best way to own Bitcoin, right? No. We all know the best way to own Bitcoin. There's no one who could ever argue there's a better way. Even Saylor will tell you this, that you know, the best way to own Bitcoin is to self-custody. He gets that. But they are one layer of the adoption stack, okay? So you have self-custody individuals. Great. We would love to see everybody self-custody, and Natalie, bless her heart, keeps pushing for this and pushing for this. But, you know, and all of us true Bitcoiners, we're trying to say, how are we going to get to this part of self-custody individuals, this utopia that I'm there with you. Then you got private companies that, you know, may have a few hundred Bitcoin, 1,000 Bitcoin on their balance sheet treasury. They're a private company and maybe in self-custody and maybe in Coinbase. And you've got these public treasury companies that now are under a lot more scrutiny, and then they've got to figure out ways to get insurance, and then they got stock and they got shareholders. Then the ETFs, which is a convenient way for a lot of people to get exposure and understand it. And by the way, when people say that BlackRock's one of the largest holders of Bitcoin, no, they're not. Their customers are, right? Let's not forget that. And then you got the sovereigns, right? When the nation states start to own it. And so what does each layer do? Each layer expands the addressable capital base, right? Because each capital base has to have get exposure and they have to play under the rules that they're playing on. And so all of this, in my opinion, and I'll probably get killed in your comments, but it all strengthens the Bitcoin's monetary network. Without a doubt, it strengthens the Bitcoin's monetary network. And it's kind of like a civilizational lens to it. It's like, you know, you can't have just 8 billion people all owning their own Bitcoin and there's no companies and there's no sovereigns and there's no, that won't work either, right? We're not going to go back to this pure 8 billion barter economy.
Well, not right now, but I hope to get that to that point okay. A couple of generations ahead.
What's the bridge to get there, right? And so I think that's kind of our role. I mean, I've found numerous ways, and they're not boating accidents. They're just stupidity, right? I said, hey, I'm going to open a restaurant. That didn't work. I tried a software startup. That didn't work. You know, I went over to some other adjacent Bitcoin investment for a while. That didn't work. So I found very creative ways to cut my stack down to well below where it used to be. But at the same time, I've got this underlying kind of moral ethos that, yeah, this is something that I feel is my time on earth. I've got to be a part of. And you too, and Yakumo, and all of our weird groupy cult that I don't call it a cult because a cult needs a leader. But it's a leaderless cult, right?
No, we're the ones leaving a cult. That's why also I had a chapter in the first book called Financial Atheism, which meaning not alluding to that absolutely no God or anything, but the skeptic, you know, we verify what you said. We don't believe when there's no need for gods or priests or anything in Bitcoin. You have to do the work yourself. You have to verify that is true. So the way I view it, we're the ones leaving a cult. I mean, the dollar bill is the thing that has the Illuminati pyramid on it, not the Bitcoin. So
yeah. Well, so like, do treasury companies create systematic risk for Bitcoin? Absolutely. Each one of these companies that says we're going to become either a pure play treasury company or we're just going to put Bitcoin on the balance sheet. Yeah, there's some risk being created. When I was at the Bitcoin for Corporations conference, the strategy one last year, one of the custody companies, one of the big ones, I won't name them, but the CEO of the custody company gets up there and he kind of makes a joke in the middle of his presentation about how even I don't know where it's kept. And half the room got it and said, that's good. And half the room was like, what do you mean you don't know where it's kept, right? And so for a custody company of that size, to the process, a public company being audited by Ernst & Young or PwC or whoever they're audited by, is there insider threat? Holy crap. I just refuse to believe that on these big, massive ones, they could go through the 17 steps and collude with all the people that would have to collude to run with the Bitcoin, okay? Now, at a small treasury company that has 30 Bitcoin on the balance sheet and, you know, the son of the owner, you know, decides he wants to run with it, absolutely. But that could happen anywhere, anytime. So the treasury companies add some systematic risk to the Bitcoin world, absolutely. But the only way we're going to figure out how to do it right is by scraping our knee a few times. And that's what's happening right now. There's a bunch of knees being cut up pretty bad.
That's a good way of viewing it, I think. It's trial and error like everything else. That's the fiat around and find out part, I guess.
Yeah, no, I mean, my short time at Strategy, I was just so impressed and awestruck at how professional and diligent they are, right? And Michael Saylor is of a different breed. He is so dedicated to what he's doing, and the critics of him, anytime I hear a critic of him, I'm like, yeah, you're not understanding what he's trying to do. I mean, there is absolutely, in my opinion, zero risk. Can't be zero risk, but the number is so infinitesimally small, right? Of anything happening at Strategy, it's just that they're on a mission. I almost said mission from God, but I didn't. They're on a mission, right?
Yeah, still, like, the thing that worries me about all of this is that the nature of Bitcoin is different than the nature of ownership of anything else. Because in Bitcoin, the private key is just a string of information. Like if I go deep philosophically, as you know I like to do with these things, then I'd say, like, my deepest understanding of Bitcoin is that you cannot own a Bitcoin. What you can do is act as if you own them, because you find it extremely implausible that someone else has the access to your private key. And you also find it extremely implausible that the network would agree to change the rules to such an extent that would render them, that decision would render your Bitcoins not valuable anymore. That's why we're having this BIP 110 internal conflict now. That's the vigilance of to me, that's a sign that the immune system is working, regardless of what side you are on that debate. It's the fact that there's a war going on inside Bitcoin is to me a sign of a healthy network, because it is reacting to a threat or a perceived threat. When I say that I own Bitcoin, I don't really mean that. What I do is that I know this private key. I know that the likelihood that someone else knows it too is so small that I can discard it. Therefore, and I also know that the 21 million cap is so memed into reality now that it will never change. Therefore, I can act as if I own it, but I don't really own it. And is this fundamental difference in how Bitcoin works from everything else on Earth? I mean, that's not true for a shitcoin, for instance. In a shitcoin, it is very likely that the rules will change and that change will render your shitcoin worthless. Like, that's a real risk there. It's not at all as big of a risk in Bitcoin, because Bitcoiners are resilient to that stuff. The network itself, the human beings behind it, are resilient to attacks. So what I mean by that is that all of these counterparty risks, so when you say that you need 17 people to collude at Coinbase to run away with the Bitcoin.
I didn't say Coinbase.
Or whatever. Yeah, you didn't say Coinbase, but at one of these big ones. To me, that's not very much. Like, 17 people could collude. Like, it's a real risk. Because the knowledge they need to take the money and run is 30 characters. Like, it's a private key. It's 12 magic words. If someone utters those 12 magic words to someone else, okay, they got multisig. Yeah, so it's not one person's 12 magic words. It's a couple of people's 12 magic words. But still, it's the nature of the asset just being information that makes this counterparty risk so much bigger than with any other asset. If you're going to steal gold, you need trucks. You need somewhere to store it. You need to take it abroad. You need a private jet. Like, what do I know? I'm not an expert in robbing banks of gold, but I know that it's much easier to steal Bitcoin if you have access to the private key. It is also, by the way, ironically enough, why it's so hard to steal Bitcoin from someone else, because you can point a gun at my head and say, give me all your Bitcoin, and I can simply refuse to give up my private key, or I can give you a small amount. You have no way of knowing how many I actually had. And that's true for every person on Earth. You cannot know. You can make a guess, but you cannot actually know how many Bitcoins another person has access to, simply because of the nature of the thing. It's not a thing. It's information. It's just information, which is why, I called it element zero once, and this informational element without protons and neutrons. It's just the electrons. The information about the element is the element. And that's... Yeah. It's part of what makes it so amazing, because it can exist everywhere at once, and we can beam it through space and time at basically no cost. That's why it's so mind blowing.
One of the things that I love about Bitcoin events, as you're walking around, is that you have no idea how much each person has, right? You know, Saylor's the CEO of Strategy or chairman or whatever, and
yeah.
I came from the world of manufacturing, 25 years in manufacturing. And you knew who the CEO of that company was and the head of engineering. And, you know, this guy's just a sales guy. This guy's a technician. And there was a pecking order. There was a hierarchy of people and companies, right? The bigger company, the smaller company, whatever. You go to a Bitcoin event and you just don't know. You know, the more powerful ones are the ones that are more eloquent, the ones who are able to, you know, they have more power in the room. But, you know, that's fine. It's just they have a podium, they're able to get on stage and say what they're saying, but you really don't know who has what. You know, it's always fascinating to me to start talking to some random person in the hallway, and I look at them and I go, does this guy have 100 sats or 100,000 Bitcoin? I don't know, and I will never know, and I shouldn't know.
No, and this is another aspect of the whole thing that I fell in love with this conference specifically, because all of a sudden the playing field was leveled. All that matters was merit. So like all my old credentials, none of that mattered. I come from shipping, as you might have heard, or we talked about in Amsterdam, I think. But in Bitcoin, I was nothing before I wrote the book, and all of a sudden I was someone. And your CV didn't matter anymore. The only thing that mattered was what you actually said and what you actually wrote and what you actually stood for. And I absolutely love that.
Your actions.
Yeah, your actions spoke louder than words, finally. And that is also why, like this, of course, Saylor, for instance, has an aura of authority around him. And very few Bitcoiners are immune to that. I mean, I was starstruck the first time I met him, and I'm usually not starstruck by meeting people anymore. But he has a certain aura around, and these Jordan Petersonian lobster serotonin level hierarchies, they're a real thing. Like we do form hierarchies, and some people have more inherent authority or whatever than others, but the thing I fell in love with this community was that it was so devoid of that. We had all this saying of Slayer heroes back in 2017. We were much better at that by the way, and everyone, if anyone said anything that wasn't ethical or that was like out of line, then we just destroyed them online and said that you don't have to listen to Roger Ver anymore. That's the culture in Bitcoin that I grew up with, and that's the thing I fell in love with. Here were these, you know, wonderful contrarians that were right about stuff, and they were relentless in just not letting false information come through.
Having spent some time with Michael, you know, behind the scenes a little bit, and not very much, but some, no one should ever feel starstruck by him, right? I mean, if you feel starstruck by him, it's just by his conviction, right? And he is a genius in certain areas, right? That he just knows and understands, and ChatGPT has just taken his genius and blown it up exponentially. You know, his ability to take a thought and then blow it up into 100 thoughts that would have taken him another 10 years, he's now able to do in a weekend. And so that part of it, you can be starstruck with. But he's just another dude, you know? It really is.
We all are. And once you get over that hurdle and...
We're all just another dude out there. And the ones who try to pretend that they're you know, something more important or bigger or whatever, you should really question and go, what is this guy hiding behind? I want to take issue kind of with... calling treasury companies shitcoins, which I'm not accusing you of having done, but a lot of people are doing. Self-custody, it changes individuals, right? They're able to feel that they have self-sovereignty for the first time. And it's like, oh my God, I own my money. Or as you put it, you own this concept of owning money or whatever. The treasury companies change capital markets. And Bitcoin needs both. We got to have both, because if we don't change the capital markets, self-custody and each person owning their own Bitcoin isn't going to do it on its own. It's not enough. We need to change the capital markets. And the only way to change the capital markets is through these projects. And in that case right now, it's treasury companies. But 3 years from now, you know it's going to be something different. 3 months from now, you know it's going to be something different. I wake up every Monday and I dread picking up my phone to look at what people are talking about now, because it's like, God, man, in the shipping industry, did you ever wake up on a Monday, every Monday, and go, oh, look, the shipping industry is different? No. I was in the rubber industry. Yeah. I'd go to the same rubber expo in Hamburg, and it was like, nothing has changed. It's the rubber.
A condom is still a condom.
No, this is tires. It was mostly tires, but like
other types of rubbers.
Michelin had a airless tire, and it's like, oh, that's cute. But then we moved on, and it's just like, you know, there's 0.1% improvements every year. You get into the Bitcoin world, and it's like, it's going to be something new.
But that's a trap.
Yeah, I know. And so I think that's what we need to do is we need to keep going to these events. We need to be on the podcasts and the digital conferences and all this stuff and keep talking about it. Because when you see that light come on for someone and they at least want to buy the ETF, that's a step, right? It's a step.
Yeah.
And I will stand by my statement that orange pilling's over just because that it's supposed to be over, right? The early adopters are a smaller group. You can't orange pill everyone. It doesn't work that way. What the early majority needs to decide is, what does this mean to me? What does it do for me in my life? And the same way that if I walk out of a building and some guy's saying, look at this umbrella, it's got 12 ribs and it's got a button that lets you eject it and it comes back and it ejects back. And I'm just sitting there going, dude, how am I going to not get wet? You know? And then the other guy says, here's a piece of cardboard, hold it over your head. You know, it's like, my problem is getting wet. You know, I don't care about all the technical details. And it's another concern of mine is that the Bitcoin early adopters are techies, and techies can't help themselves sometimes. And they just get into, you know, the halving and multi-sig and this and that. It's like, no, man, just sell it as another asset for now. Let them get into it. Let them see the returns. Let them hear this. Let them hear that. You know, give them a copy of Natalie's book. Give them a copy of your book. Maybe they'll read it. Maybe they won't. And it's a slow process. But this isn't biblical. Coming back to, you know, you don't have to be this devout Catholic that swears to the Vatican. You just got to say, what does this mean to me? And why do I think change is necessary?
I think Luke Dasher might have a different opinion on that specific point.
Of course he will. Of course,
anyway,
he will.
Yeah, insider joke. So you said before that your role in this is sort of to vet these companies and like when you're doing this for these conferences and stuff and picking and choosing between sponsors and trying to get the honest ones. How do you do that exactly? Like, how do you know who's honest and who's not?
No, don't put me in that the level of responsibility.
Thought process there?
I mean, we look at, you know, whenever we get approached by either a treasury company or a service provider or somebody who's looking to invest a lot of money, even the ones who are looking to invest a lot of money, if I see that they're just looking to short squeeze a stock and then, you know, flip it and whatever, I'm like, yeah, stay away from Bitcoin. You go play in the stuff that you play in. So it is incredibly difficult because each one of these treasury companies that comes along, I made this comment to someone in Las Vegas last week. It's like each treasury company is like a woman. Each one is different, right? And there is no pattern yet. There is no way to do this. There is no perfect model for this. And each one's just trying to do it a little different. But when I hear that they're getting, you know, like short-term financing out of the Cayman Islands and it's with a subsidiary out of Isle of Man, and the alarm bells start to go off. And you start to go, okay, well, either I'm going to do some more research on you or we're not the platform for you, because then I'm going to be liable, right? I can't tell you that there hasn't been a company that we've had on our podcast, had on our shows, had on our events that's going to come back and burn me. It'll probably happen. And they'll be like, oh, you said that one. And I'm like, no, all I did was I gave them a platform. And it turns out that, you know, I didn't know everything. It happens.
Yeah.
But if the people running the events, you know, like having Luke with BTC Hell, you know, having people like that or Nifty with all the great work she does and stuff, it's having these OG people, these core Bitcoiners that are like, you know, we need to kind of hold the line and not let this drift off into, you know, turning it into something that it wasn't meant to be. Those are the events that we need to support. Those are the podcasts we need to support and say, like, you know, this is how we're going to hold the line. This is how we're going to maintain the truth.
Yeah, absolutely. So what events are coming here in the short-term future?
Oh, like, my God.
Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah. So if you go to bitcointreasuries.media, you'll find the list of all of our events. Tim and challenged me with us doing 21 events in 2026, of which most of those are digital online events. So don't think we're doing 21 in-person events. We got a call from Aldana in Madrid that wanted to do the Madrid Mad Bitcoin, which is beginning of May. We're doing a Bitcoin Treasuries Done conference with Andrew Webley and Smarter Web at the end of May. We're doing an event at the Bitcoin conference. It's the pre-party on Sunday. So if you're coming to the Bitcoin conference in Vegas, make sure you get in early enough Sunday. We're doing a huge pool party at the Stadium Swim, which is not related to Bitcoin necessarily, but anytime you get the chance to get 500 Bitcoiners drinking around a pool, that's a good time to, just get your thoughts out, get your conviction out and talk to other people. So there's just all kinds of them. We're doing our big event will be the Bitcoin Treasuries Unconference in New York in September. And we call it the Unconference because I treat it more like a town hall. Put the stage almost in the middle of the room. Don't introduce people from their company just by their name. The agenda is voted on by the ticket buyers. And we do a town hall. And we just say, like, hey, move the mic around the room and let's talk about this. So that's kind of the reason we call it an Unconference. It's not these traditional pass the panels and I agree with the previous panelist crap. And then August, we'll be doing one in Buda in Norway. Just Glenn called me out of the blue from Buda and said, I want to do an event here. And I'm like, okay, let me find Buda on Google Maps. And I had to keep scrolling up and up and up.
Yeah, it's far up there.
Yeah, that's why we call it Bitcoin Beyond 66, because it's in the Arctic Circle.
Yes.
But it's just a beautiful location. And it turns out that Norway, this country of 5 million people, El Salvador, 6 million, has so many big names. I just saw your episode with Hodlnot. He's going to be there with Efrat doing a discussion on freedom of speech. Just some big names in the Bitcoin space in Norway. Some really great companies.
Yeah, I'm hoping to get to that one myself too.
Yeah, smaller events, 400 people, right?
Yeah, and the Madrid one is the other one that I have.
Madrid will be a little bit bigger, but that's just because it's the first time there's been an event in Spain. And then we'll see what else comes up. We just did a very small one at PubKey in New York for Bitcoin treasury companies in emerging markets with Mexico, Brazil, and South Africa, talking about how these Bitcoin treasury companies can have an impact on these emerging market countries. That was just like about 50 people in the back room there at PubKey. So yeah, bitcointreasuries.media is the place to get to our Luma page where all of our events are listed. And then you got Tim Kotsman on X, you got Tim Kotsman on YouTube, and he's just a fantastic interviewer of just, getting people to tell their stories and having us share them. So, same way what you're doing. But if you are, hardline opposed treasury companies, hold the line, conviction that they're bad for Bitcoin. If you don't understand it, well, then take some time to understand it and see what's really going on and why we need to break into the capital markets, why we need to have this pump out of fixed income, this pump out of bonds into Bitcoin, because otherwise they're just sitting there going, I can't invest in Bitcoin. The system doesn't allow me to. Now, will that change one day? And the pension fund of Sweden will be able to just buy Bitcoin and self-custody it someday? But that's a long way off. And in the meantime, they hold shares of MSDR or they hold IBIT or whatever.
Yeah, I believe they do have, it's called Sjunde AP-fonden. It's a Swedish, where most Swedes have their pension money. And they are invested via some third party into Bitcoin. So they do have exposure, whether they like to have or not. So there's no getting around it. And yeah, just to have said that, I'm not vehemently against Bitcoin treasury companies. That's not but I do... tend to take the devil's advocate sort of position when I'm arguing, because that's why how you find the interesting stuff, right? So I'm keen to learn more about this. Absolutely, yeah. Looking forward to the events, regardless of how many it'll actually be. The Buda one is tricky for me because I will just have arrived from Michigan. I'm going to Michigan just before that with my family for 2 weeks, so I would have to just hop. hop onto Buddha right after that. But it's doable, of course. We'll see where it lands if I end up there.
That one I'm expecting to sell out, because after Buddha Glimpt wins the Champions League, I think that we're all going to want to go to Buddha. But yeah, that's been a great story there as well. But but thank you, Nuv, for everything you're doing in the Bitcoin space, for keeping us all honest, for your books, for your academy. There are suit coiners out there, and I'm going to define what suit coiner is, which is, you know, people that come from, I'm not wearing a suit today. I have a suit over here where I put the orange tie on when I need to, but it's people on Wall Street. If you were to go to Central Park and yell Bitcoin, thousands of people would come running to Central Park. They're out there. I mean, I knew this because when I worked at the Bitcoin conference, we had dozens of people from Citibank, BlackRock, Morgan Stanley at the conference using their Gmail, their Hotmail, their Yahoo Mail. They just couldn't come in an official manner. And so when you get to these companies and you say, once again, I won't name the financial services institution, but I found out that they have an internal chat group of about 500 people that are all Bitcoiners, and none of them work in the same department, but they're all, you know, chatting about Bitcoin inside the company. And then eventually, occasionally, that sneaks on up to a Larry Fink, right? Occasionally.
Yeah. No, this is my experience too. Like the thing is, like I've traveled the last 5 years, for the most part, I've traveled to a lot of different conferences and meetups and all sorts of Bitcoin events. I've just said yes to everything basically. And I know, to some extent, you're always surprised by how small it is everywhere, but then you realize that the key word there is everywhere, because it really is everywhere. Every one horse town in every single country has a Bitcoiner or a couple. We're absolutely everywhere, and most Bitcoiners don't even go to conferences. There is a Bitcoin scene like absolutely everywhere. And I know here in Spain, for instance, there's a meetup at least once a month in Alicante here, and same in Murcia, and same in Valencia. Like, it's getting everywhere. And in Germany, that every single big city has a regular weekly meetup, and it's been like that for years. So
they're not growing, right? This was my thing. In 2016, when we were doing the Bitcoin meetup here in Atlanta, and we had, 100 people, I'm like, wow, one day this is going to be 1,000 people, and it's not. It's actually less people now than it was before, right, in the local meetup. And this is where that early adopter, early majority. I think what us early adopters need to do is we need to figure out what this means for the early majority, interpret it for them, make sure they're keeping them honest. And I think that's where these meetups are going to go. It's going to be about, okay, how do we onboard our neighbor, our doctor, you know, this company, the local government. One of our local guys has been coming to the meetup since 2013. He's now starting a political action kind of thing here in Georgia to try to address the Georgia state government and educate them on Bitcoin. There's a fantastic group in Illinois that's doing this. It's a large group of people, and they're really making progress with the Illinois state government. And so we're on a mission. We're on a mission, man. And it's hard, right? Because you just keep getting beat down and beat down. But Bitcoin will keep us all honest.
Absolutely. I think that's a great way to round this out. Bitcoin will keep us all honest, because it really is a truth machine. It forces people to behave honestly. It's more expensive to try to cheat it than to just follow the rules, and that's what's going to keep us honest going into the future. So, yeah, you mentioned this site, bitcointreasuries.media, to find all the conferences. Where can people find you? Is there anywhere else on the internet where you would want people to go, and something you want them to check out or what?
Yeah, I mean, me personally, I'm E. Julien, E-J-U-L-I-N-E on Twitter, but we have BTC Digital Conf is our handle. You can find all this on our website, but yeah, I'm not hard to find, LinkedIn and everywhere, and Signal, but no Telegram. It's we all seem to find each other and connect with each other and follow each other, and always appreciate when people reach out saying, you know, how something I said or something Tim said, you know, impacted their allocation of their investment portfolio or got them to think about something. So don't ever hesitate to reach out.
No, fantastic. And I enjoyed this conversation a lot, and I'm looking forward a lot to seeing you at some of these events later this year. So until then, all the best.
You too. Hasta luego.
Hasta luego. This has been the Bitcoin Infinity Show. Like, subscribe, and brush your teeth, and adieu.